So I haven't looked at Revelation since last week. I had a busy
I just finished editing it, so yesterday. So it's fresh.
week. I think that we ended at,
I think verse 16.
yes, that's what I was just going to say, verse 16.
Was that of chapter one?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I got a note from Nancy saying that she and Brad couldn't be here today, but she was thinking about us. I'm sure they would love to be here. Bill,
Yeah.
would you please read verses 17 to 20?
And this is Revelation 1, 17 through 20, Free Bible Version. When I saw him, I fell down at his feet as if I were dead. But he touched me with his right hand and said, "Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last, the living one. I was dead, but look, now I'm alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and the grave. So write down what you've seen, what's happening in the present, and what will happen in the future. The meaning of the seven stars that you saw me holding in my right hand and the seven golden candlesticks is this: the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven candlesticks are the seven churches."
This is not the Jesus that John leaned against his breast. Now, I'm not saying that he's a different Jesus. I'm just saying that John sees him differently in this picture,
Closer to what he
which is all the more reason why Jesus had to come in the flesh. He's now appearing as he will when he comes again.
sort of like the prince and the pauper.
I don't know that I would use that, but
Well, like he goes and lives as a
as
pauper,
a pauper, yeah.
or
Remember,
actually
though.
closer to what Ty Gibson wrote, "The Seeing with New Eyes," I think years and years ago, where he wrote this story of a, like the king wanted, he caught somebody, caught his eye, and he wanted to marry them, but he knew he wanted them to love him for who he was, not because he was the king. So he went and lived, as a peasant for some time until he earned her affection and finally won, ask her to marry him, and then reveals who he was to her. So Jesus comes and he demonstrates his character, like Isaiah says, with nothing that would attract you outwardly.
Right.
And then once he wins their hearts that way, John, this is closer to what John saw on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say, but he still doesn't. There's still something in the context that he's receiving now in this revelatory vision that even that makes it a little bit different. And I just wanted to say, to me, it sounds like another atonement theory in the making. I fell down because I was afraid, and he came over and he just touched me and said, "Don't be afraid." And so, oh, we're at one.
That sounds like a good atonement theory.
It for me it goes back to the way it is with God, that every time, no matter what it is we're afraid of or why, and the bias and assumption we bring, he reaches out and he says, I've got you covered. It's okay, we're one."
He put, I love the fact that he puts his hand on him. That is that reassuring touch. That if you just said, "Don't be afraid," it sounds like another command I have to obey. Oh dear, I better not be afraid. But no, when he puts his hand on him, that's a statement of don't be afraid because there's no need to be afraid.
I got a question that just popped into my head while right before we read this, and I had never noticed this before. Both before and after it says he put his hand on him. It specifically says that he had seven stars in his right hand. And then he uses his right hand and puts it on him.
That's right.
So did he still have the stars? No, I'm sorry. My logical mind asked all these questions, but.
I think you're dealing with, if you were watching a movie, a person goes out the door and the next thing you know, they're somewhere else. How did they get there?
Yeah.
The magic of film editing.
Yes. Or simply, they didn't go there in the film.
No, but then the possibility that, I mean, these stars, even like in a Disney movie, they're sort of moving and swirling around and they're just hovering there. And they stay there, and he puts his hand on him, and the next thing he knows, he's giving all these messages from the stars to the seven churches.
Well, and I have to admit that as I read it, I can't help but picture some basic metaphor meaning of holding it in the right hand, being touched by the right hand, being irrelevant to the reality of how it all works.
Right, right.
More for the purpose of why it's there.
Yeah.
I don't know, Gene, you're the one who knows the languages.
You know, I don't know. I think all of us have a piece of the puzzle, but to me, it strikes me that in the middle of him giving messages, Jesus makes sure that John is not afraid. It's like he's in his heavenly mode.
Mention.
But he still reaches down and goes, don't be afraid.
He's aware of the other, and the other has just quaked in his shoes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is aware. And to me, that is so much like Jesus and so much like God. Because how many times in the Bible does God say, don't be afraid? Mm-hmm. Even in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I have to, this is my personal testimony. It's being a little bit vulnerable, but I have a little high anxiety because of having Asperger's. And the thing I hear the most from God is, have no fear. Don't be afraid. All the time. He never tires of telling me that. So I think if there's anything God is concerned about, it's, I can tell a story on my dad. He's not here to defend himself. When I was a small child, he was under duress, or I don't think this would have ever happened, but or else he panicked with my brother's actions or something. He gave him a very stern scolding that was just out of character for him. I didn't know what to do with it. My dad was gentle, soft-spoken. I was standing there right behind my brother, my brother just stood there and took it. And I went into the kitchen where Mom was right afterwards. And I said, Mommy, I don't like it when Daddy yells at Don. It makes me afraid of him. And then I turned on my heel and walked away. I figured it would get where I wanted it to go. Because I knew my mother. Years later, I was about 13. And Dad was teaching piano lessons to one of my classmates. And one morning at the breakfast table, he said, you know, I taught Carla her lesson this morning, and she said that I made her afraid of, that I made her afraid. She was afraid of me. And I was a careless adolescent, budding adolescent. And I said, oh, I can see how that would be, Dad, because I'm kind of afraid of you too. I was being careless. I wasn't thinking. And I remember the agony in his voice when he said, Gene, do I make children afraid of me? And I realized, oh, I said that badly. I said, no, Dad, you really don't make me afraid. I just am afraid of disappointing you by making mistakes in my piano lessons. I never forgot that about my dad, that he was the kind of person that, of all things, he did not want to make a person afraid of him. And to me, that's God.
Well, I mean, I know we are flawed. So the potential for doing that is very true. Even God, who wasn't, you know, and he spoke lovingly from Mount Sinai, right? But the place where the people were at, all they could hear was either yelling, thunder, whatever.
Lightning. Well, he came down to make that display because they were so prone to worship other gods that didn't have, and they were only impressed by power. They were not impressed by love.
So it strikes me that, and I think this was it while we were talking now or and before the recording, that we can have a heart, an operating system of selflessness, but come off or be received by others because of where they're at as selfishness for us. So I'm wondering if we have a heart that doesn't make people afraid, that we can sometimes be received in ways by tonal inflection and their own experiences with people that infers, and I certainly know I've grown over time and I'm probably more safe today than I've been in the past, but that doesn't mean everyone is safe with me. So, and I don't know how to explain that. I just wonder if your dad was learning and becoming more self-aware and this is part of our growth trajectory.
The reason he was frightening to her, I think, is because he had difficulty talking to individuals. He could carry on a conversation if you hit the right buttons, but he apparently suffered brain damage as an infant with whooping cough. His probably suffered brain damage, and he had a hard time finding words to converse with. And that was all his life. It wasn't an age thing. Okay. So he was very quiet and silent. And some people are afraid of people like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what made my classmate afraid. I grew up with Asperger's, so that was fine with me. I liked dad's silence. We could drive for hours. He'd drive me places and we'd go for hours without saying a word. I think he wished I would talk because my mother was a great talker. But I didn't oblige him. I was just enjoying the silence.
I think in this case, there's also the factor that when a human being is suddenly exposed to a whole another dimension that's unfamiliar, that's supernatural, that's enormous with power, especially in that short of a time. You know, it wasn't like he was walking and things were getting brighter and brighter. No, he turns around and boom, it's right there in front of him. All this amazing, spectacular, unimaginable, you know, glitter and power and energy and light. And as humans, we're overwhelmed. And overwhelm is our automatic reaction is fear, because we don't know that much power. Is it safe? You know, it's how do I fit into this? And so Jesus has to connect with him and say, okay, I'm going to be with you and take you through this. You know, I got a whole bunch of even more spectacular things to show you, but we need to do this together.
So I was just, you know, I wasn't with you last week for the session. I was just rereading the beginning. And it does strike me, John begins, or the writer of Revelation, which he says is John. So beginning this with, you know, the normal stuff. Peace and everything with you and from Jesus, who's the trustworthy witness. And then he moves on with, I am the beginning and the end. Verse 8 says the all-powerful Lord God who was, you know, and then a little self-revelation. And so it's interesting that he starts this way. Then he finds himself in vision. And this is, you triggered me on this in a good way, Floyd, that John now finds himself, this is all head knowledge and some experience with Jesus, but now he finds himself in vision on the Lord's day, right? And it is very different. And the voice and what he had envisioned with his experience of Jesus suddenly is not even the Mount of Transfiguration, but the experience of all-powerful in a way that you would think, knowing, right? Knowing Jesus as the revelation of God, all-powerful being John 13, taking up the basin and the towel, and yet in this moment, he reverts back to that fear, the moment of fear. It's encouraging for me.
Because he's never seen that much power.
And yet it's just, that kind of power is still the power of service and love.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of how, what Ellen White describes when the saints, you know, when Jesus comes. And then there's this awful period of silence when they actually see him, and suddenly it's like the last vestiges of fear are surfacing. Mm-hmm. They can't help it, and the questions, you know, am I good enough, am I right with God, you know, what does he actually think about me, is he safe, I you know, all these questions are boiling out, which they've been boiling out for quite some time and being dealt with, but now the last amounts of it surfaces, which I think is necessary. And I think that's why Jesus waits for all of those doubts to come out in the open, so that when he says, my grace is sufficient, yes. Whoo, they're all gone, and that's the last of them. There isn't any more coming out. And I see that happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about that last week quite a bit.
Okay. Sorry for the repeat, but thank
how
you.
That, no, it's important to reiterate. To me, that encapsulates the character of God. He is gracious. When God made himself known to Moses, as a recap from last week, the first designation of his character is a God gracious. That is his character. Mm-hmm. Is first and foremost gracious.
I love that word gracious or graciousness to replace the hackneyed word grace. Mm-hmm. Because grace has become so religified that...
Well, it's become a commodity.
It means anything but graciousness.
Yeah, it's become a commodity instead of a character attribute.
Yeah.
In God's own self-designation, it is character. It is who
graceful, gracious. All those things have very positive attributes in my thinking, but grace doesn't.
Just one little note, and this is not important. I'm not trying to offset anything. Everything that's said has been really good. But I was struck by his falling on his face. And Daniel is one of the books that Revelation is most built on. So I can't help but see Daniel 8:15. Now I, Daniel, needed help understanding the vision I saw. Suddenly standing in front of me was someone who looked like a man. I then heard a human voice come out of the center of the Ulai Canal. It called out, Gabriel, help this person understand what he is seeing. Gabriel approached me, and I was terrified when he came. I fell with my face to the ground. Gabriel said to me, know this human one, vision is for the end time. As soon as he said this to me, I fell into a trance. My face was still on the ground. Then Gabriel touched me and set me up on my feet. But he does not say, don't be afraid. If the Son of Man, or the one who looks like a man, had come to him, he would have said, don't be afraid. It's interesting. I have the sense, and this may be wrong, that the angels love and admire God for who he is. But because they've never fallen, have never sinned, they can't comprehend the intimacy, love, mm-hmm. that we can have.
Is it also true that they can't comprehend the depth of fear that we have?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
So they cannot resonate with the fear.
No.
I never thought about that. That's really profound. I mean, they can intellectually understand it. They can figure out how to relate to it, but they really don't feel it.
It's one thing. Yeah, they don't experience, have never experienced it. And what you don't experience, you cannot comprehend fully.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can only dimly perceive it.
We learn from others. We don't need their experience. But we also never enter their experience because we aren't sharing that.
Right.
And at the same time, I sit there and go, so they have something to learn from us, but we also have something to learn from them. There's dimensions upon dimensions of the onion, the layer upon layer.
They've had an experience pre-fall and post-fall that we've not had.
Correct.
We only dimly perceive what they went through with Lucifer.
So they have much of the story to fill in.
Rocks on both sides.
Yeah. But I can easily see where Gabriel is like, why on earth are they afraid? Mm-hmm. Except cognitively to know that it's true.
Yeah.
It's almost like the analogy that we have the Quran version of the story and they have the biblical version of the story.
Mm-hmm. But they have it only in perception and intellect. And to the extent that they themselves experienced it, but they haven't experienced our journey. And I think that's what led Ellen White to say that the redeemed are going to be closer to Christ than the angels themselves can ever be.
So sometimes the Luke 15 story, maybe I've mentioned this before, comes to my mind that the unfallen beings who remained loyal, they may not have the resentment, but they have the big brother experience. And the son who had rebelled and was welcomed back has an entirely different experience.
Mm-hmm. Except that the angels aren't unwelcoming.
Correct. Like, correct. No. So it's not a one for one, but
join the party.
Yes, they'll come in and they'll have fun and they'll celebrate. But there's a part of it that does, you know.
I understand what you're saying, Bill.
Oh, you.
It just struck me funny that, you know, they're not going to go stomping off.
No, not in a huff. No. That, so, you know, but every story has like multiple levels. And,
oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the Pharisees that refused to join the party.
Correct. Yeah. Well, yes. And it was the warning about refusing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just love that whole chapter, but that's a whole squirrel rabbit hole.
Well, shall we go on to the next chapter?
The keys of death and Hades. I think that's really pivotal.
Keys of death and grave.
Yeah. Mine says Hades.
Well, it could be Hades in the Greek, and somebody's just translated that as the grave.
Right. And
Hades is the Greek word for hell.
When he says, I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, I find that, well, for me, that is one of the most pivotal doctrines that has been lost. Not the fact that Jesus is alive, but that what I now see as central in the New Testament thinking that I think has been almost completely obscured in our awareness is this battle, the supernatural battle that went on over who was allowed to represent humans in the assembly of the sons of God in heaven. And I think that is central to the issues through the whole story of the great controversy. I mean, since the creation of this world, because Adam was supposed to be the son of God that should have always gone as the assembly of the sons of God. But because Adam gave away that authority, Satan then
claimed it,
seizes it, and he represents humanity for 4,000 years. No, people don't think about that. I mean, that was a terrible situation. Your accuser is the one who represents you, you know?
Yeah, the only thing that puzzles me then is about Job. When God says, "Where have you come from?" it sounds like he's not supposed to be there. And then he says, "Oh, I've been walking up and down upon the earth, going to and fro upon it. This is my domain,
my authority."
And God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" So as long as God has people who cling to him, Satan does not represent them.
That's true. And I think, yes, I think God was challenging his authority, because Satan was making a blanket statement. Everybody operates selfishly, just like I said you do. And these are your reflectors, and they're all being selfish. So end of discussion. And God's like, not so fast. Why don't we bring Job up here and let him? Oh, no, 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 no.
Oh, you let me have him.
Yeah, you let me get my hands on him, and I'll prove that he's selfish just like you are. That's the whole book. But then you come down to when Jesus comes to this world, suddenly Satan realizes my credentials for being able to represent humanity are going to be challenged. That's why he fights tooth and nail every second of the life of Jesus, because his permission to be in that assembly and represent humans is being directly challenged by Jesus. And Jesus comes down and claims Son of Man authority. I believe this theme is central, and that's why the apostles were like crazy ecstatic, which confuses us when we don't understand that issue. They're like going crazy in Hebrews and everywhere. It's like, well, we've got a high priest now, which is the representative in heaven, who understands us. He's not our accuser. He actually likes us. He's there defending us, and he's going to live forever, so he'll never lose that position like Adam did and betrayed us into the letting the accuser represent us for 4,000 years. And so I see this coming back up here in Revelation, and Jesus is assuring John, yes, I died, but I defeated death, Hebrews 2. I neutralized Satan. He can't represent anybody anymore. I represent humanity, and I'm alive forevermore, which is an absolute guarantee that it will never be lost again.
So I'm going to chime in. You've got me thinking about a lot of things. A few things I hadn't thought of, but I love the idea of a universal Senate where, I see Job supporting that idea. So I love that whole idea. I love the idea that the usurper in Eden claims authority. From my perspective, though, it's always just a claim. And the whole basis is an empty seat for Earth, usually claimed by the adversary. And I love that the adversary is the one accusing the very people he's claiming to represent. But to me, it's always a claim. And there's no, while I see the incarnation as the best representation of the counterclaim, it's the Senate looking at the conflict with God on earth and the accuser and the counterclaims. And so it's never that the adversary loses his seat. It's that he has been revealed to have a false claim on the seat.
Yes, I agree.
It's not like suddenly being bought off or anything. It's mm-mm. All these claims and counterclaims, and the truth is finally revealed. Right. And the Senate is like, oh, you know what? We might have had some sympathy with you before, but you're a jerk. There's no room in this auditorium for you anymore.
But think about
it. We're not listening to you.
Well, keep in mind that before Jesus became a human, there wasn't any alternative.
See, and I have to think that there were, but
yeah,
but
that, I kind of think when it came to God's people, Yahweh was their representative. Because in Zechariah 3, you have Joshua the high priest standing before this Senate, as you put it, Bill. He says, Yahweh says, Yahweh rebuke you. Yahweh, who chose this man, rebuke you. He's talking about Joshua.
But notice the location of Satan in that.
He's in heaven. Oh, yeah.
But he can't come to heaven. What is his position in heaven?
I see him in Job as an intruder.
But in Zechariah, it specifically says Satan was at his right hand.
Yes.
Which is the authoritative place of power.
Right. It's the claim. It's the
yes.
claim.
And I believe that yes, Yahweh has always tried to represent us, but legally, which Satan's the biggest legalist.
From his perspective, yes, he's our representative, but I don't know that that's God's perspective.
There was this conflict all this time, and so when Jesus comes, see, I portray it as Jesus has to create a resume and apply for the job. Well, he has to challenge everything that's wrong with Lucifer's resume.
Okay.
You know, the biggest one being Lucifer is not a human being.
Yeah.
How can he represent humans? He's not human. That doesn't fit. And so Jesus becomes fully human. Therefore, he now has legitimacy to claim that seat, which he does. And he also never gives any authority to Satan's rebellion. That's just why he was tested his whole life. Because he was always loyal to God as Adam before the fall. So he only reflects God. He never takes things into his own hands until finally when he's crucified and he finishes his resume. Then he's resurrected and he doesn't know because they took a vote while he was dead, you know, in the Senate. You know, are we going to accept this resume and oust Lucifer and allow Jesus to have this? But, you know, God lets them vote on it. And so Jesus is like, I really want to know what the outcome of the vote was, but he's too busy taking care of Mary because he's got too much compassion and he won't leave her. So he sends her off to do some business so he can rush up there. And Ellen White describes it very well, where he brushes aside the angels. He refuses any worship. He doesn't assume any authority until after he goes into the Father and he says, was my resume accepted? What was the vote? How did it turn out, you know, in our terms? And he says, more than enough. It was unanimous, overwhelming. You know, they see the whole picture now. They are totally on our side. You have the seat. You have the authority. Now he comes back to earth and he's like, I've got the keys. I've got all the keys. I've got the keys to hell, to death, to everything, because it was given to me, both by heaven, by vote, and I am the representative on earth, officially now. And Satan is no longer allowed in there. They even changed the security system for heaven. Did you read about that?
Yeah, the golden cards.
The golden cards. They won't let any of those, you know, fake angels be sneaking in there under a guise. Like, no, you got to show your pass.
I'd like to bring up something that you sparked, Floyd, quite a bit earlier. If, you know, Satan, Jesus has to overthrow everything that Satan stood for. And of course, Satan only believed in judicial forgiveness, not real forgiveness.
Yeah.
He had a tizzy when Jesus ate and drank with the sinners that he had picked out as tormenting because of their sins. And so he inspired those teachers of the law and the lawyers to harass Jesus because he ate and drank with sinners. He was not acting according to the prescribed kind of law that Satan invented in Babylonia.
And I think Satan was escorted out of heaven by the MPs, kicking and screaming and protesting.
Oh, I'm sure he didn't go quietly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about the eating and drinking with the alleged sinners. Could they not have been closer to the kingdom of God than the Pharisees?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Because they welcome
them. But I was looking at this from Satan's perspective.
Right. Eternal life is this, that you
know me.
Intimacy. Yes.
And that word know, you need to know in the Bible, is most often very experiential. And it means intimate knowledge.
Yeah.
And of course, the sinners knew Jesus more intimately than the Pharisees. That's just.
And they were much more responsive to him.
Yes.
And I think that was because open sinners are not trying to pretend. They're like, we're just that's being true. Honest and real. But that's exactly what God's looking for, is honest and real. Not how good you are, but how honest you are. And they're like, well, we're honest. I'm a prostitute, and I'm not even trying to hide it. And it's like, okay, you're already a step closer to the kingdom of the Pharisees. I find it much easier to deal with honest atheists than I do most Christians. In fact, I admire them for having the courage to reject such horrible, ugly views of God that I had to struggle with most of my life. And they're like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would I believe in a God like that? Forget it. I'm like, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the sons of God and the assembly in Job. To me, the sons of God is the rest of the universe. It's not a representative group. It's everybody that is being revealed. And the question at that gathering to me is what Satan's accusing is that God doesn't know his people. You don't know Job. Let me show you what he's really like. Mm-hmm. Give me a chance. I'll show you what he's really like. And so I see that as the
and whole you
universe
that,
there who's learning about this conflict, not by representation, but everyone individual.
And you notice what Job does. I mean, what Satan has to do. He doesn't pick anything in Job's life currently. Mm-hmm.
No.
Something he has to bring out of him by torture.
Yes.
That's a satanic way.
Okay. Yes. Well, he accuses God of being the sugar daddy and says, well, if the sugar daddy cuts you off, then you'll reveal who you really are.
Which is the spirit of commerce.
What's that?
He is the spirit of commerce, which is undergirds everything in Satan's kingdom is. You earn, you purchase, you buy, you have an expectation of a return on investment. God, you've been investing in them, but you're only doing it as long as they're worshiping you.
And again, it reminds me of the claims. So everything, I mean, even in the garden, it was the serpent's claims against God's claims or instruction. And that just seems to be the echo throughout time. And that because of the, I mean, it always, we talk about it as so clear. And I can only assume that these unfallen beings were far more brilliant than us. And it was sophisticated and subtle.
Yes.
And that it was so sophisticated and subtle that it wasn't, I mean, it was confusing to the onlooking universe that Jesus would incarnate. It was confusing that he would be vulnerable. It was confusing that he would grow up. It was confusing that he wouldn't be somebody great. It was confusing that he would allow himself to be murdered. It was, you know, everything was confusing the whole way through. And all of this is to be the counterclaim and the evidence of the Old Testament with the revelation of Jesus was the entire counter argument. And it had to have made sense once Jesus was resurrected. I don't know. Maybe some made the connections earlier, but it seemed like universally the decision was made out there, whether it was at the death and or resurrection. The clarity had been given, and now we're dealing with the claims still with our own lives. I sit there and I just go, I don't want to be such a great friend of God that I get into a Job situation. And yet I want to be a good enough friend of God to have the intimacy for salvation. You know, it's a little bit contradictory. And so what I end up seeing is what John experienced. And I haven't even seen Jesus the way John sees him in this vision. But it's the gentle graciousness touching my fear and saying, I'm with you, you know, and that's the calm, soothing strength to see me through the adversary's arrows. I don't know if that makes sense.
You know, you were talking about the brilliance of the angels, and I reminds me of the comment that it wasn't until the cross that the angels lost all sympathy with Satan. So on that basis, I wonder about the brilliance, and we're obviously not the slowest learners in the universe because we don't get as long as they had for that.
Remember, Satan is more brilliant than they.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he did was so confusing. And they didn't have the backlog that we have with the history of the great controversy, by which hindsight is always clearer than foresight, regardless of whether you're an angel or a human.
I believe that what was made it confusing was the subtle influence, which we still have in our thinking today, which makes us confused, because it was the influence, like we said earlier, Satan, Lucifer said, I can improve on God's government. Well, what is God's government?
We think
we're already starting from an issue of confusion about what God's government is.
Exactly.
And God's government is selfless love, freedom, total
trust.
That's the part that gets washed under the rug all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And vulnerability, which, like, vulnerability, that's crazy. And so Jesus comes, and no wonder they kill him. This is not the kind of government we want. This is not the kind of God we're going to worship and serve. No, 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 absolutely no way. And we're still the same way today. I remember it took me a long time to get past the dissonance in my head to put God and vulnerable in the same sentence, or weak, or anything like that. So what, that's impossible. Well, it's impossible on the old view of God. And the angels, Lucifer's improvement was, well, you know, love is nice, but what happens if somebody breaks the rules? And the angels are going, rules, what's that? Because they'd always lived in love,
mm-hmm.
you know, receiving freely, giving freely. He's like, well, yeah, there's rules here. There's principles. And what if somebody rebelled? What if somebody screwed everything up? There needs to be a deterrent in place. This operating system needs a security update. That's what Lucifer was proposing. He claimed to be defending God's government, mm-hmm. not attacking it. Mm-hmm. He claimed to improve it. That's what made his argument so compelling.
Yeah.
It wasn't an open attack. It was saying there's an inherent weakness here, and weakness is a liability. And if somebody exploits this liability, there's going to be chaos. There's going to be suffering. And we could avoid all that simply by making some artificial laws with some artificial punishments, like we do with children, right? so that nobody makes any mistakes. And if they do, we slap their hand and they get back in line. And this whole artificial system, which is based on commerce, that's why I think it's so important to take seriously Ezekiel 27 and 28 as the very foundation of Satan's design, which is commerce. And God says, because of the multitude of your trading, your excessive trading. Well, what's trading? Trading is giving somebody with an expectation of a return, which was foreign to the kingdom of heaven. Everybody freely received and freely gave. They weren't expect. There was no string attached.
There's another meaning. I think it's kind of secondary, but there's another meaning for that word trading. And that is pandering, slander.
Which is Romans 1, exchanging
the truth
of God for the lie.
Yeah. So if you put those two concepts together.
Yes.
Gene.
I got that from Dick Davidson at the seminary.
You have used the word God is dynamic. Yes. At least that's how
he's
I think.
He's not static, as opposed to like, he's not static.
Well, and so a commerce, transactional, legal government
framework
is more static. You can change the rules, right? But it's less flexible.
Mm-hmm.
So a dynamic one is most interested in, so correct me, this is how I get it, I understand it. So I'm looking for correction. The dynamicness of God is saying relationship with each other and me is more important than some details.
Absolutely. Okay. The whole Old Testament is highly situational.
So when we look and say, we like to say Romans 13, you know, love is the satisfaction of all law. We as in humanity twist that and say, oh, it's not that love, which is dynamic, is important. It's that love can be defined under a set of rules and applied statically. So we've taken what was intended for incredible intimacy and dynamic relationship.
Yeah.
And turned it into transactions.
So we reversed what he said. We say fulfilling the law is love.
Well, and this is why I read Paul, and I get it why people go, you've thrown off Paul, right? Because they're in a transactional mindset of Bible reading, and they take Paul as a legal scholar. And I take Paul as an incredible legal scholar flipping it on its head into relationship.
Yes. He is not. He does not promote a legal gospel. He is against anything legal for its own sake. That's what I concluded in my master's thesis in Romans. But I want to mention something about the dynamic legal transactional thing. I had to show you how steeped we are in this and how prevalent this is now in our thinking. I've taught classes for 30 plus years. Because before I taught full time at PUC, I was also an adjunct professor from 1989 to 1995. And so I've asked this question a number of times in my classes over the generations that I've taught. I've taught part of the Gen X generation, the entire time period of the millennials I taught. And then now I'm teaching the Gen Z generation. So I asked a question the other day in class of my students because I was trying to illustrate God's way of running the universe. And I asked if they had made a contract with their roommate. This is a question I've asked, I don't know how many times. And I get stares of, what are you talking about? I remember one class I asked why didn't you make a contract with your roommate? And they said, because I trust my roommate. I don't need to make a contract with my roommate. But I asked it this time, and heads were nodding. Yeah, we made contracts with them.
Wow.
That was a sad moment, because I have a harder time now explaining why God is not a transactional God.
Family, although I suppose that can also be dependent, I look at long-term committed partnerships. Marriage is the most common one that we see, but there are people who are, for all intents and purposes, married, who've never had a marriage ceremony or contract. So Trixie and I have a marriage license signed by Eugene. But what comes to me is that there's no, other than that is used by the state to recognize the state of our union, there's nothing transactional listed about duties and responsibilities. And I, we have our book and we have our vows that we've made to each other to, you know, the desire to honor, cherish, and respect in our own words. That's a commitment that is made and a choice that's daily. But if you were to reduce it to the obligation that I have to get up in the morning and make Trixie our coffee, you know, and you've taken the joy of the relationship away from my willing service and made it a legal transaction. Now, I'm not saying you, but I'm just saying that we can do that. And it seems to me that we lessen intimacy by making it transactional.
We do. It becomes a legal relationship instead of a natural trust and love relationship.
That's dynamic.
It's dynamic,
and,
yeah.
And growing.
It's intended to be dynamic, yes. I had an amazing conversation with a class years ago. It was an ethics class. And I would take them through the Ten Commandments, particularly the last six. And we were coming to the seventh commandment. And I'm not one to pussyfoot around things that I'm concerned about young people doing. And one of the things I have is the rampant fornication that goes on in today's generation and that generation. And so I kind of apologetically opened the floor to discussion about it. And I explained why the Bible is hard on fornication. And I'm trying to remember now my key text for this and how I did this. It's been years since I've actually taught this, because I don't teach ethics anymore. If you look at Genesis chapter 2, the very last verse, this is the reason that a man leaves his father and mother and embraces his wife, and they become one flesh. And that word embraces is weak. The Hebrew is cling to. And it's used of Leviathan to describe the scales on his back that cling together so completely that the wind or the air can't get through. That's very tight clinging.
Like shrink wrap.
How better than shrink wrap, I think. I pointed out that what God wants to spare us from. I said, why do some people able to do one night stands with someone and then do it again the next night with someone else? Why can they do that? And I said, that's because their relationships as children got ripped apart by their parents. And they have a terrible deficit of love. And they hide it behind doing sex to try to fill that deficit. And I pointed out that if you don't look at marriage as a legal proposition, but as a love, trust relationship, then that cling to, If you rip that apart, that is just horribly painful. And so when God said, don't fornicate, he wasn't trying to spoil our fun. He was trying to spare us the scar tissue we would get on our emotions by over and over again ripping that apart so that we can't cling to as well and so that we constantly get hurt again and again. And that whole class just opened up. They talked about their pain. They said how they wish somebody had told them some of the things that I told before they had done what they're doing. And I remember walking across campus and seeing one or two of them, and they would look at me with this little smile like, that was awesome. Because it gave the ones who wouldn't fornicate a non-legal reason, a non-authoritative reason, a non-fear-based reason for maintaining that abstinence of fornication. And I mentioned that I think we did damage by viewing marriage as a legal thing, there was just a roar of approval in the class, you know, because they felt that fornication. Ellen White makes it very clear that a legal religion is a Christless, loveless religion, and that it does not allow us to obey. It promotes disobedience.
Does the exact opposite of what it's trying to do.
Exactly.
What it purports to do.
Yeah. What it purports to do.
Which really is describing the failure of Lucifer's security improvement on God's government by creating artificial laws with artificial punishments that are ever increasing until it's the death for anything. And it doesn't work. You know, and yet we're still doing it in the world today. Every government in the world relies on punishment as a deterrent for crime, right? And but how well is that working? Well, fear does work for a while, but it actually drives people to do the very thing they don't want to do. You got Romans 7 all over again.
Yeah. I was just going to say one possible exception is Sweden. Their prison system is rehabilitation.
Well, that's what I was going to say is when you have systems for rehabilitation and restoration, then the purpose and point of it is I think for me, it comes down, are your systems for civilization punitive or restorative? And I think if we're saying Sweden, and I haven't studied it out, but I do see the drug issues in Portugal as an attempt to be restorative as opposed to the war on drugs being punitive. And so they've demonstrated that these things work, not mm-hmm. for every human being, but because there are some who are just intent to destroy that which is around them. But for most, they've recognized the addiction is a bonding issue. And so you want to restore people to healthy community, whatever that might be. But you want people connecting, choosing to connect in community than choosing to connect with an addiction.
I think there's one prison in California that actually tries that, that was actually started by an Adventist chaplain. And they serve them a vegetarian diet. They work on establishing community. I think that's how it's worked. And it's really done amazing. Done amazingly well, but it doesn't ever make the news. What makes the news is when a policeman takes down a person and tortures them with tasers or whatever. You know, that's what makes the news. Have we completed our thing for today, or do we need to continue?
Well, how far afield did we get?
We got through a paragraph of Revelation.
Well, we read to the end of chapter 1.
Right?
Did we discuss it to the end of chapter 1?
Well, that's what I'm wanting to know. We come down to the mystery of the seven stars that you saw on my right hand, the seven golden lampstands. Stars in the Old Testament are angels. And in Revelation, they are angels. Cast down, isn't Doesn't somewhere it say it cast down the stars of heaven?
Well, in this section, the seven stars in my right hand, the seven stars are angels of the seven churches in this particular instance.
Yeah, his tail swept down a third of heaven's stars. Those are angels.
Oh, okay.
And so let me explain that, how that comes into being. The sign, the cuneiform sign for God, for divinity, is a star. Now, it's been stylized and made into something different, but originally it was a star.
Okay, and my question.
So the Bible, instead of positing stars as gods, they posit them as angels.
My God question being. Is why, I guess most of my life reading this, why? I mean, why are there angels?
For each of the seven churches?
Or the seven churches. You know, it says to the church of Philadelphia, to the church. Or no, he doesn't. He says to the angel of the church, to the angel of the church. And I'm always, why is there this differentiation between the church and the angel? Especially, hey, the question's even stronger now because I don't believe God's into hierarchy. And that sounds rather hierarchical.
Now write this to the angel of the church in Ephesus. Okay, let's go to the original translation for angel in Hebrew. Messenger. Write this to the messenger.
So is the messenger a go-between? Is it a specific being, literal or figurative, that will take the messages from Jesus and mediate them to the people in that assembly? Is there a need for a go-between, I guess, is my question.
Well, the messenger's role was to deliver a message from someone important to someone else. And they had the right to put that message in their own words and even edit it. And they had a right to negotiate with the party that received the message in order to make that message clearer or in order to help them see that message as compelling. I don't mean compelling in the term of loss of freedom, but compelling in the terms of something to respect. And there could be, what followed could be negotiations.
So you're talking about an ambassador.
Messengers were often ambassadors, yes.
Well, that would be an interesting
thing. In terms of the ancient world.
To the ambassador of the assembly at Ephesus. To the ambassador, to the, wow, that I like that.
Only the ambassadorship of angels was more of ministering spirits. What does it say?
Service towards.
I'm looking for Hebrews here.
But they're representing God, right? Mm-hmm. So they're ambassadors of God, but right. Not in the same way that human ambassadors are, I guess. But they are authorized. They're being authorized. Jesus is saying, well, he's giving the authority to each of the angels every time he begins talking to them.
Yeah, it's interesting that my version translates Hebrews 1:7. He talks about the angels. He's the one who uses the spirits for his messengers, and he uses flames of fire as ministers, servants. So it's always in the servant model.
Isn't that what ambassadors are supposed to do, is serve the one they're representing? And the people that they've gone to convict?
No, not in the ancient Near Eastern perspective. Ambassadors were people who defended the king, whom they represented.
Maybe they're misrepresenting the true meaning of ambassador then.
Well, when we, in the U.S.
Paul says that we are ambassadors.
Yeah, but when
God to appeal for reconciliation,
it is misrepresented all the time, because when we send a U.S. ambassador to some place, they're pro-U.S. They're going to back the rights of the U.S. They're not going to minister to the people they go to.
So we just identified another original and counterfeit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like that. I'm going to have to put that into my notes now.
Mm-hmm. sometimes messengers were just messengers. They delivered the message, they left. You know, you can't over qualify this, but there were messengers for the king, usually did play the role of an ambassador, I think. I should probably get my book on this. It's been years since I read
it. Well, too, if you equate this to some of the backstory in Daniel, the prince of Persia, the prince of this and that, there may actually be angels, literal angels, assigned to be the go-between messenger for specific areas of the world or specific groups of God's people. I find that quite plausible. So in Daniel, the contention was with the demonic spirits who were in charge of, you know, resisting. But then heavenly messengers may also have counter positions to that as well.
I think that's what I was thinking of, was the place where I was fighting this angel and I was delayed getting to you.
Yeah, that's true. But that it sort of maybe gives a hint of the arrangements or the authoritative arrangements in the supernatural, where maybe on both sides there are specific angels responsible to be very, very familiar with those that are under their guardianship. The Holy Watchers, I don't know. You know, we only get little hints about this stuff, but maybe there was a specific guardian for each of those specific groups of people, and it was their responsibility. Like you say, it's opposite of how we do ambassadorship. They were there to be on both sides, to reconcile this, you know, the Ephesians with the kingdom of heaven, to synchronize.
Yeah.
So they're working to synchronize them. And so Jesus is as the commander in chief, is calling in his generals and saying, here's the specific issues of your church, of your people. And I understand you're there to do everything you can for their benefit. This is what you need to focus on. That almost fits better than many other places in Revelation where it talks about angels that seem much more symbolic of human movements or agents or messages, like the three angels' messages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we generally shy away from saying those are literal angels. But in this case, I think it might be actually closer to literal angels, might actually fit.
Mm-hmm.
At least so far as those seven churches. Now, there's way more symbolism and everything in these seven messages that go far beyond, you know, the literal churches that don't even exist anymore.
Yeah, you know, I had never thought this through before. So this I'm thinking this through too. But from everything I've known, and I wish I could find my book on that, but it's disappeared. Messengers played a prominent role in the ancient Near East. And they still did in Jesus' day. In the Roman Empire, you know, roads weren't the only way of communication, even though all roads led to Rome. Mm-hmm. But you needed people to deliver these messages because they didn't have a postal system like we have today.
So was the central distribution post office in Rome? So if you wanted to send a letter somewhere else, it had to go through Rome?
I don't know. I've always seen that all roads lead to Rome as simply a kind of a meta. I don't know if you can call it a metaphor, but a representation of how connected the empire was.
And how authoritative Rome was.
Yes. Yes.
Sort of like all roads go to Chicago.
That's true. On the United States side, except for Alaska and Hawaii. That was, I was a child, I think, when I first learned that Highway 80 that starts in Northern California goes all the way to New York. And my father took a road trip as a 13-year-old with his parents. And they stopped in Chicago to see relatives. And they, I think they stopped in Ohio to see relatives. And then they wound up in New York. And my dad, to his dying day, that was a favorite memory of his, I think, that trip.
Of course, 66 is immortalized.
Mm-hmm.
So just thinking that the candlesticks are the churches that are coming up and being referenced, and the stars are the angels of or to.
The candlestick, menorah, is the light of the world. So these are witness churches as witnesses. These are our churches as.
So these, if we, the right way to understand this would be, or a better way of understanding it would be, a menorah as opposed to separate. I've always pictured them separate, but I love the visualization of a menorah.
Well, that brings up another thought that just occurred to me. In the sanctuary, where the literal menorah was, who did, I mean, those candlesticks, those wicks, they had to be serviced.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have oil put in. They had to have the wicks changed. They had, mm-hmm. they had a lot of maintenance. Who was responsible for that?
Priests.
The messenger.
Or the Levites.
So so this could actually be a substitute for the priest in there maintaining the candles. And these are the instructions to each one of these menorah caretakers on specific details that this menorah needs.
I don't think the angels... The stars are angels. If you do a close study of stars in the Bible, they are angels, and particularly in Revelation. I don't think that matches priests. Priesthood is, in Hebrews, it's actually obsolete, with Jesus being the high priest after the order of Melchizedek.
But the high priest wasn't the one who probably serviced the candles either.
No, but it was a lesser priest or a Levite.
That's why I'm thinking if it was a Levite doing this.
Angels and Levites don't mix well. I mean, there's nothing I can find in my head in scripture that would make a correlation between those.
Until we got here.
So, well, and so my thought is, this isn't so much, maybe I'm wrong, this doesn't seem so much a revelation for a Jewish mind specifically, but for the Christian, the new Christian mind. And it would seem to me that he's not trying to tie things together. However, clearly, as we get into the churches, I have to admit, the way it's written, it's like instructions to the angel, or to the angel, you've kind of messed up because, you know, this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah,
but it seems so more oriented.
It's right in the text that it says the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands, which are the seven churches, are the seven churches. I'm sorry, I read that wrong.
Yeah.
So it's very clear.
I mean,
and the stars are in his hand, while the lampstands are not.
No, the churches aren't in his hand. The angels are in his hand.
Yeah, what implications does that have?
That has strong implications that those seven churches are wopsing around out of his hand.
But isn't he walking? I mean, this is why, I mean, I love the imagery of the menorah, but I always picture
him amidst the candlesticks.
Yeah, just sort of, you know, like they're...
This is a very large menorah.
But the way the artist...
and he can walk between it.
You know, the artists have an awful lot of influence on our theology. And they always have these tall, single candlesticks all completely separated. I'm like, that is not at all what was in the sanctuary. You know, they have menorahs.
Actually,
I always wondered, if this is a menorah, how do you stand in the midst of a menorah?
Well, this is where I'm not sure that it was a menorah. I think a menorah is a Jewish creation later on, because they had to go to synagogues instead of having a temple. And the original Hebrew, I believe, is candlesticks. Let me check Exodus.
Well, the menorah is clearly described in great detail as being on a single stand. And it even gives the detail of the knuckles of the pears that are coming out from it and how they're all interconnected. And I never have figured out where the container for the oil was, but there's enormous detail of how to build that candlestick, and it's all on one stand. So I think that's pretty clear.
I was going to say, the thing that works for me is if the spirit is the oil and Christ God is the unifying holder of them. So then the illustration of candlesticks, because, you know, John later on in Revelation towards the end, I think John's looking for the temple and doesn't see it because God himself is. And so all of the fixtures that we have are metaphorical, allegorical for the reality of the embodiment.
They're symbolic.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a better word. So I can go either way. I just have always envisioned the description of this white-haired, whatever, being, the Alpha and the Omega, strolling through bright light and wanting to make sure and ensure that their lights burn well.
I haven't ever done the measurements for the lampstand. And you're right, it is a lampstand. But I'm wondering if the lampstand wasn't low at the base. And so the branches started out low and going up. And if they weren't this evenness that menorahs tend to have, it would be easier to walk kind of among them. I don't know. I tend, when I'm dealing with symbolic stuff, I tend not to try to literally figure them out.
Yeah.
I think it's enough that Jesus is symbolically pictured as walking among the churches.
Speaking of symbology, when I first began seriously looking at Revelation, for me, in the first verse, I found two what I call keys or filters that I use for the entire book. And I found that it's been extremely effective. And I know we had a discussion about the revelation of Jesus Christ being from Jesus, linguistically more accurate than of Jesus. So that sort of weakens one of my arguments, but I still think it's legitimate to say that whatever interpretation we come up with anything in this book, if it does not agree with Jesus' version of God, I pitch it and look for something else. And I still think that's legitimate.
That's also a principle for reading the entire Bible.
Yes. But the second one, which isn't so obvious, particularly in other translations, is that he signified it. And so actually a couple of weeks ago, when you were talking about this, I went and looked up that word again in the Greek to see, you know, what it meant. And it actually reaffirmed my conclusion from that, is that, you know, God didn't like, okay, give me a piece of paper, I'm going to sign my name. That's not what that means. But in a crude way, and you can only do this in English, obviously, but if you took signified and burst it into three syllables, what do you end up with?
Signified,
which to me says this entire book is all symbolic, all of it, which then completely eliminates all the arguments of all the theologians about, well, this is literal, but that one, no, that one's literal, this one's symbolic. No, this, I don't find any instructions anywhere in Revelation that says, well, if you'll ask Dederin, or if you'll ask Nelson, or if you, no, it just says it's signs. So now when I go through it, I don't care how literal it appears. I'm going to approach it as if it is a sign. It's a symbol, which means it means something very important. It may be a symbol of something literal. And that does not preclude the fact that it could also be literal. But primarily, the symbology needs to be explored before ever entertaining if there's any literal to it. And in doing that, I have found if I use those two standards for looking at everything I look at, and then I try to explore the symbology and let the scripture inform, you know, what the symbols mean. Wow, this book has just come alive in a way I've never seen before.
So I was thinking, would, so the instructions are to write this and give it to the seven churches that are outlined. Would they have received it and understood it in a unified way, or would it have been meaningful to each one in a unique way?
I think it's quite personalized.
Well, part of it is it certainly was intended to mean something to the seven churches. And then I do struggle, like with you, Floyd, that we make the book say something and then we make those somethings compete for a truth reality, that I find that process of competing dogmas or ideologies or theories, they have value, but do we have to make one compete over another? I there's an echo, I think it's of C.S. Lewis. It was, and I'm probably butchering him, but the idea of it is all of them have value, but some are more valuable.
That's why when I look at various options for what the symbols mean, and I find value in many of them, they're usually not compatible with each other, but the way they're in their own context, they have value. And so I said, okay, I'm going to remain open that it could represent this. It could be historical. It could be future. It could be both. But what is the one that emerges that seems most relevant and best fits into the flowing narrative?
And that's the qualification is, and you had said it earlier, fitting in with the character and revelation of God through Christ. And so many of the explanations seem to fail that, if you will, test.
That's right.
So I'm trying to decipher the word dexe, or dexe, Revelation 1, revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him. And I think the word in the King James Version is signify.
It comes a little signify later to in the his verse. Servants. It's a little later in the verse.
Which must, okay, my verse reads, a revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants, what must soon take place. Jesus made it known by sending it through his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the witness of Jesus Christ.
I think it's where it says made known. In the King James, it says signified.
Yeah.
When I looked up that word, it actually means mark, which is what a signature is. You know, you make a mark.
But
which is a symbol. A signature is a symbol of something. It's not the real thing.
Said to his servants to, this is not, I'm looking to see if it's, I think it's genestai. Oh, my Greek is rusty.
No, the word is samai, no. It's 4591 in Strong's.
I don't have Strong's. It's
close to the end of the verse. Right close before angel.
Essay my name?
Yeah. Yeah. Mine says S-E-M-A-I-N-O in English.
Right. That they're giving you the form of the root.
Right.
Whereas I have as written here.
It says from sema, a mark of uncertain derivation to indicate or to signify.
So revelation, I'm looking here in the reader's lexicon that I have. There's phragizo, which is seal mark, a test. I don't think that's it. Let me look at chapter one. Yes, make known or communicate is what my reader's lexicon has. Semino.
Yes, semino.
From which we get the word, I think, semantics. Or what's the word for?
So that would be a very different Greek definition than what Strong picked up. I wonder what the discrepancy is.
Languages are not like math.
Yeah.
Literature is not like math, where you have one value for everything.
Right.
And what's happened over the centuries is Strong is old. It's very, very old. It's it's before they realized they were doing textual criticism wrong. It's in the 1800s, or about the time they decided they were doing textual criticism wrong. And so, semino, let me see if I can find it here. So this is Scott and Little, which also is older than my Greek reader's lexicon. And it says, and let me tell you, I did a word study of Dikaiosune by looking through Plato, at least some of Plato. I don't think I looked in Aristotle, but I looked at various writers through the century, and I discovered that it did change meaning over time. So you have to pay attention to when it's actually used. So this says, starts with the future of Ion, which is your early Greek. And then later writers, it says, show by a sign. See, a reader's lexicon has to choose among many, many definitions, and it can maybe miss it. Okay, so the first definition, I believe it says, show by a sign, indicate, point out, indicating the person.
Which would really correlate with John making a big deal in his gospel about signs, right?
Yeah, he does. The Pharisees do. They make a big thing about signs.
Well, but John says this was the first of the signs.
Oh, that signs there are miracles, but of course miracles were signs in the sense that you're using it. So I think there's room for your perspective, but I needed to work that out before I was sure. Because you also have, this is the revelation, and a revelation is usually something that discloses and unfolds and uncovers something that otherwise is covered up. And and we think of a sign as covering something up.
So what if the signs, what if symbols are being used to reveal?
Well, that's all very possible, but our modern minds have a trouble with that because we don't use it that way. So that's why you get these different translations.
I just find it very, well, most of my life, I found it very disturbing that we would have to go from theologian to theologian and try to sift through their opinions about, well, now the Holy City, that's literal, but then this is symbolic. I mean, clearly the beast is symbolic. Well, some people think it's literal. There are endless arguments about who we're going to believe to define what's symbols and what's literal. And when I read this, I said, what if I just said the whole thing was symbol? What would happen?
I've tended to do that with Revelation, but I have my friend Dan Smith will tell you everything's literal unless you know it has to be symbol. And that's, I think, the standard Adventist view.
Everything's literal. I've heard that.
Has to be symbolic.
It's still dependent on who you're talking to. Because some people say, well, the dragons has to be literal then. And other people say, no, that's obviously symbolic. Well, obvious to who, you know?
It's obvious to me because the dragon and the beast are both taken from Job, the behemoth and the leviathan. The behemoth means beast. The leviathan is obviously a dragon-like creature, chaos monster. That's where they get their old. Yeah. And so for me, doing Old Testament antecedents is far more clarifying than getting stuck on who's right.
I just find it, well, I found it to be actually, what can I say, extremely expanding, that when I went through it, I said, I'm just going to take the stance that everything here is intended to be symbolic primarily. Again, not excluding the possibility of literal, but God saying, look at it as a symbol before, and do everything you can to flesh out what the symbol means before you then say, okay, this could also be literal. And as I've done that, and I've taken things that appear to be obviously literal, and I say, well, but what if it's a sign? Let me see what it might imply, what meaning may come out of there. And I've seen volumes of stuff come out that fit perfectly. Everything else that nobody bothered to look for because they said they just dismiss. As soon as you say it's literal, okay, we're done. Next.
Mm-hmm.
You don't explore. Well, maybe it means something, you know?
Yeah. See, that's to me, even if it's literal, it means something. And that's to me what has been the tragedy of Adventist theology, is that when it's literal, it just doesn't have any meaning.
Exactly. Yeah.
I you know, take the story of Jonah, tremendous meaning in that book. So yeah, I think you have a point to make, and I've tended to read Revelation that way. I tend to read the lake of fire as symbolic, because if you study the word lake, never has any meaning of fire in the entire Bible. This is very unique to Revelation. But if you study fire, there's lots of meaning.
I came to the conclusion that the lake of fire and the sea of glass are the same place. And the difference is, from our vernacular, what's the difference between a lake and an ocean? How do you know if you look at water, how do you know the difference if it's an ocean or if it's a lake?
A lake is fresh water and an ocean is salt water.
Okay.
That's the standard distinction.
Okay, but that's not the Great Salt Lake is saltier than the ocean. So
I know.
Okay,
salt and sea down in Southern California.
I think a lake defines a limited period of time, as in the difference between the apparently infinite distance of an ocean. Whereas you can see across the lake many times and you say, okay, there's an end to this. So the lake of fire, which is torment, not imposed torment, but it's torment, there is an end to it. Whereas the sea of glass there is no end to it. It's infinite. But the sea of glass is shot through with fire too.
Yes, it does. It does. The lake of fire, I see as emotional torment.
I do too.
And I base that on Ellen White at Signs of the Times, April 14, 1898, where she makes that very clear, I think. She doesn't refer to the lake of fire, but she talks about the worm that does not die and the fire that is not quenched. And she says, by this is describes the, and she, it comes out to emotional agony of the wicked. Probably we better stop our discussion. This is definitely more like a classroom than a usual Bible study. But it is really a Bible study because we've been really racking through the Bible. Let's have prayer. Gracious Father in heaven, we thank you that we never cease to be amazed that the more we study, the more there is to learn. We thank you for guiding us this afternoon with your Spirit as we pursue understanding these sacred texts. We thank you for your wisdom, and we pray that we may be faithful to what we learn. In Jesus' name, amen.